On this edition for Saturday, November 21st, hospitalizations continue to climb as COVID cases break more records. Measuring the relationship between climate change and extreme weather.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
And Art Garfunkel with notes from an underground man. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments.
For 25 years, Consumer Cellular's goal has been to provide wireless service that helps people communicate and connect. We offer a variety of no-contract plans, and our U.S.-based customer service team can help find one that fits you. To learn more, visit consumercellular.tv.
Additional support has been provided by and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
Good evening, and thank you for joining us on this weekend before Thanksgiving. States and local governments across the country are reimposing curfews, trying again to slow the spread of the coronavirus as the number of cases continues to break records. There are now more than 12 million reported cases in the United States as of this morning, with nearly 200,000 new cases recorded yesterday, according to the New York Times. Some states, including New York and Ohio, have already imposed a 10 p.m. curfew. In California, a limited stay-at-home order with a 10 p.m. curfew for non-essential gatherings will begin tonight for dozens of counties which cover most of the state. Takeout and delivery for restaurants and grocery store visits will still be allowed. New cases in California have more than doubled in the past 2 weeks, and hospitalizations have increased 46%, according to the New York Times. Globally, the virus is also still spreading. In Tehran today, officials imposed new restrictions on travel and non-essential businesses for much of Iran as the country grapples with a third wave of infections. In Mexico City, rapid testing kiosks are being set up as the country recently surpassed 100,000 deaths. Mexico's death toll is fourth highest in the world, behind the United States, Brazil, and India. President-elect Joe Biden and Vice President-elect Kamala Harris met with transition advisors in Wilmington, Delaware today. They had no public events. There are recounts underway, including in two Wisconsin counties. Other states are finalizing their vote counts in preparation for the Electoral College to formally announce its decision on December 14th. The Trump campaign legal team continues to pursue lawsuits challenging ballots in several states, losing almost all of them so far. President Trump insists with no evidence that he actually won, saying it again yesterday at a White House announcement on prescription drug pricing. The president has made few public appearances since the election. Today, he went to his Virginia Golf Club again after attending this year's G20 Leaders Summit, which is being held virtually. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo arrived in Doha, Qatar today with plans to attempt to restart negotiations for peace in Afghanistan. The talks between representatives from the democratically elected government of Afghanistan and Taliban insurgents have been frozen over a procedural disagreement for months now. Earlier this week, it was reported that officials on both sides were in communication and negotiations might resume. The talks have taken on increased urgency in light of the Pentagon's recent announcement of plans to reduce U.S. troop levels from 4,500 to 2,500 in January. Meanwhile, in Kabul, Afghanistan today, rocket attacks struck residential areas near the Afghan capital's Green Zone. At least 8 people were killed and dozens more taken to the hospital with serious injuries. The Islamic State in Afghanistan claimed responsibility for the attack. According to a Pentagon watchdog report, attacks in Afghanistan have increased by 50% in the period between July and September of this year from earlier in the year. For the latest national and international news, visit pbs.org/newshour. Tens of thousands of Hondurans have been left homeless after flooding and damage caused by Hurricane Iota. The storm struck Honduras earlier this week as a Category 4 hurricane with sustained winds of 155 miles per hour. Rain from the storm flooded neighborhoods and swelled rivers. Iota was the second Category 4 hurricane to hit this part of Central America in 2 weeks. Hurricane Eta caused more than 130 deaths and triggered mudslides as it made its way across the region. Iota is the 30th named storm of the Atlantic hurricane season, topping off a record year that resulted in the National Hurricane Center resorting to the Greek alphabet for letters. As this record hurricane season officially comes to a close at the end of this month, we wanted to understand more about what's been discovered about the connection between climate change and extreme weather events like hurricanes. I recently spoke with Kevin Reed, an associate professor at Stony Brook University who leads the school's Climate Extremes Modeling Group. I began by asking him how scientists are teasing out the effect of climate change on individual storms.
When storms make landfall, they make an impact. They have hazards. And those hazards come through things like storm surge, high wind speeds, and rainfall, right? Because extreme rainfall can cause flooding. And so one of the things we can do is we can use state-of-the-art models that are used for forecasting storms. And we can run these under different conditions that have climate change to date in the signal or removed. And so we basically come up with two sets of reality.
So you're taking a forecast like we would see on a weather channel, and you're saying, what are the impacts that climate change could have on this storm? And then we take a look at kind of two outcomes, with the rain and without the rain, that's attributable to climate change.
Yes. And so another way to put it is we run a forecast just like we typically would. The difference is then we also run a forecast in which we've removed the climate signal to date, right? So in the North Atlantic, that's approaching over, 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. The sea surface has increased in temperature over the last 150 plus years due to human-induced climate change. And we can remove that signal and we can rerun the forecasts. And so we basically have two sets of forecasts. One we call the actual forecast, right? The kind of the real forecast, as well as the one in which we have this counterfactual, in which we've removed warming.
When you look at a storm, say, for example, like Hurricane Laura now, what does this type of modeling tell us?
Yeah, so this type of modeling tells us that what we call the maximum accumulated rainfall amount, right, which is just the fancy way of saying how much rain fell during the lifetime of the storm. We're seeing increases in that of 5 to 10%, meaning that if in the example of Hurricane Laura, we had about 12 inches of rainfall in some regions. And so that's an increase of about an inch in some cases of rainfall. So we're attributing how much rainfall in an individual hurricane is due to climate change.
When you are looking out into the future, are we likely to see more storms or more intense storms or both?
Yeah, so, that's to some extent an open question still. And the consensus is that there will be a decrease or the number of hurricanes, for example, globally will remain about the same or decrease. What that means for individual basins like the North Atlantic is a little bit harder to understand, in part because there are things like natural variability from year to year, right? But we do know, our models do tell us that the storms are becoming more intense, both in terms of the maximum wind speed, right? But also in the amount of rainfall. We expect about a 5 to 7% increase in rainfall within tropical cyclones, within hurricanes, for every degree Celsius of warming that we have. And so if you see in the North Atlantic, right, if we were to flash forward 50 years and the North Atlantic is, 2 or 3 degrees warmer than it is now, then you could start to expect upwards of over 10, maybe approaching 20% increases in tropical cyclone rainfall.
What are the data sets that you're looking at now that you hope will help refine the way that you model things, the way that people can prepare going forward? I mean, is there a way that we could look at hurricane forecasts when we're watching TV before the storm sets in and realize that this is going to be worse each time because of all of these other factors of sea level rise and ocean temperatures warming?
Yeah, these type of analysis in which we're able to kind of quantify the impact of climate change on things like hurricanes, as well as other extreme weather events, has definitely increased in sophistication, meaning, each time we do these type of things, like most things in life, we're getting better at analyzing the data. We're getting quicker turnaround in terms of running simulations. And I think that in the future, we could have a system in which we're doing that real time. Not only are we exploring the impact of climate change on the storm that occurred to date, but also providing some future, a peek into the future. What would this storm look like under 1 or 2 or 3 additional degrees of warming? And I think that that would help both inform decision-making, right? To see, okay, this storm was really impactful. How much worse would this storm be in the future? But also it allows, to communicate that the impacts of climate change are not 100 years off. The impacts of climate change are here now. They are changing the weather around us, and they are having a real impact on society through that.
All right. Kevin Reed, Associate Professor at Stony Brook University. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Last week, New York City's Administration for Children's Services published a survey that found that more than a third of kids in the city's foster system identified as LGBTQ. The same survey found that LGBTQ foster kids are more likely to be placed in group homes than with foster families. Other studies throughout the country show that these youth are overrepresented in the foster system. To learn more about this issue, NewsHour Weekend correspondent Yvette Feliciano spoke with Mary Keene, a senior advisor at You Gotta Believe, a New York-based organization that specializes in placing foster kids with permanent families.
So, Mary, starting off, what was your reaction to the findings from the survey published last week by the Administration for Children's Services?
So there is really nothing surprising in it. This information is known. People working in the system and working with these young people, they're aware of the increasing number of teenagers who are in care. And in that population, we all know that they're LGBTQ kids, and they have what I call a double whammy. You know, they have sort of extra struggles beyond what the average teenager has.
In your experience, why do so many LGBTQ youth end up in foster care?
Some of them have the same challenges that other kids have who wind up in foster care: family dynamics, family struggles, family trauma. And then in addition, there's family rejection. Families who just don't know how to handle a kid when they come out and identify. And that's, you know, I mean, we may be in New York and we may think we're very sophisticated and stuff like that, but there's still a lot of people who have a challenge with that.
And once they're in the foster care system, what are the unique challenges that LGBTQ youth face?
So I think, again, to emphasize, all kids in care, I think, face challenges. It's not a good place to be. Teenagers face special challenges because they're just labeled. They're seen as problems. They're seen as, you know, troubled kids. People who take kids, you know, as foster parents aren't often willing to take teenagers in general. And then you say that, well, they're LGBTQ on top of that, and they really don't want to deal with it. They frequently wind up in residential treatment centers or group homes because they don't have families that are willing to take them. And the LGBTQ youth, when they're not in a specific LGBT group home, they face challenges from peers who may not be very accepting of.
So what happens to these young people once they age out of the foster care system?
So again, it's really very similar to all kids who age out without a family. They wind up overrepresented in jails. Incarceration rates are very high. Homelessness, that was in the article too, the percentage of LGBTQ kids in the homeless population, a great majority of which had been in foster care. Any youth who ages out of the system without a family is unlikely to succeed.
How does your organization, You Gotta Believe, help LGBTQ youth and support them when they're in the foster care system?
Any youth that we work with, and it's for us, it's the same. We're finding them a family. Nothing else matters. If they cannot be reunified with their birth family, and that's the first attempt, then you try to find someone in their circle, and they, you know, they're older kids, they know a lot of people. You try to find somebody there who can be a parent for them. And if not, we have people who come in, I call them random families, who are interested in parenting older kids. And so we prepare them, we train them. All of our trainers, all of our program staff actually are adoptive parents and alumni of the system. So this is all very personal for us. And this applies to whether the youth are LGBTQ or straight kids, or if they're not even sure what they are yet. Our families are taught they have to unconditionally commit to a child that's placed with them.
And you yourself are a foster parent.
Yes.
You know, from your own personal experience, what are the takeaways about youth in the foster care system and what they really need to thrive outside of the system?
What I learned from the kids, because I didn't learn it in my training, I learned from the kids what they needed was someone to really just love them. And that's a term that's not used in the business a lot. Love is what heals trauma. Love is what heals kids. Love is what heals people. So what they needed was someone who's committed to them, who saw them for who they were, who accepted them completely. It didn't matter what their sexual orientation was. They've lost their family, not because of anything they've done, and they deserve to have a new family, an additional family, really, usually, because they still maintain their families, but they have a new committed family that will be there for them for a lifetime.
Mary Keene, Senior Consultant at You Gotta Believe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Readers and fans won't find earth-shattering details in Art Garfunkel's book, What is All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man. But in the year since its publication, the singer-songwriter and author, who turned 79 this month, does have some fresh insight on his life as one of the world's most famous duos and his longtime relationship with Paul Simon. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has more.
My old friend, I've come to talk with you again.
After so many years and so many shows and so many questions about his relationship with his on-again, off-again partner, Art Garfunkel has, in recent years, been working on securing his side of the story, whether in his 2017 book, What is All But Luminous? Notes from an Underground Man, or the occasional interview. Garfunkel is talking. I sat down with him just before his book was released in paperback.
I was very nervous coming here to do this interview. This is all very serious stuff. There's a lot of people out there. I want them to like me. In my opinion, I've been under the radar all my professional life. It's time to say, who is Art Garfunkel? When you're
weary. While seemingly not interested in the complete retelling of his life, Garfunkel is indeed offering notes that, when put together, can be considered part memoir and part diary.
When I was five, I knew I could sing. I sang in the alleyway in our house in Queens. I sang wherever there was good reverb, tiled rooms, hallways, school. When the kids would finish school and leave, I would linger in the hallway to sing. And I discovered I had a nice voice, and I went very private with it. And when I found Paul Simon, three blocks away. At age 11, I found the same kind of turned on New York kid working on getting better and better at something, the guitar. We were natural mates. We have warmer times and colder times. The fact that he's this Queens fellow who's so damn different from me, and that we made a togetherness, is a hell of a trick.
For those hoping for more about his at times tumultuous relationship with Simon, Garfunkel is not ready to go there, sticking instead to the content of this book.
And you yourself say, you know, if you're looking for the big, deep biography, that's not this book. That book is coming.
Yeah.
So is that book coming?
Yeah, I'll get to that. It was great joy to write this. It really suited me. I felt early in the game, I'm a writer. I can do this. So I'll do it again, and I'll go into Simon and Garfunkel more.
What Garfunkel is offering right now are broad contemplations about his life and how his work may be remembered. Big questions that, for Garfunkel, started to ring a bit louder in recent years as he struggled with the loss and recovery of his singing voice.
Well, when I couldn't sing, I began to sit at the round table in my place and started working on this thing. That became an alternate. So that's a big part of why I wrote it. I can't sing. I'm still creative.
And did it change the way you think of your own legacy?
Legacy. I've heard that word. They like that word a lot these days. I don't have a legacy. I don't know what that means. I have a wife and kids. I have a family. I know what that means. What is my legacy? The world and all of its glamorous stars is a hit parade. They come up and then they go down, except for J.S. Bach. He seems to stay up there. But I'm discouraged at how we love certain people and then it fades. I've heard kids say, Sinatra, who's Sinatra? They never heard that word. I take this very poorly. I want them to think Simon and Garfunkel has they were indelible. We did something that has value through the decades.
And do you really question if that's going to be the case with those records that you made back then?
Well, it's everything's here and gone. That's why I use the Sinatra example. You mean we forgot that name? It's kind of all here and gone.
But isn't that everything anyway?
And isn't it discouraging?
I don't know. I'm of two minds. On one hand, I feel that it is discouraging. On the other hand, I feel like it's freeing.
It's freeing.
Because why suffer? We're here to do our work, and if the tree falls in the woods, maybe someone's there to hear it.
We're here to do our work. Is the work worthwhile or worthless? Let's say it's worthwhile. Is it good? Is it very good? Is it extraordinary? Is it worth saving amongst civilization? Do we want to save it like we saved Beethoven? Is it really worthwhile? That's a key question, certainly when I'm recording.
I contend, though, that 100 years from now, people are still going to be listening to The Sounds of Silence.
Well, thank you. We'll see.
And whispered in the sound.
These questions are, of course, impossible to answer, but they are the questions that busy Garfunkel's mind.
And do you think the artistry that comes with singing, does that allow you to quiet these thoughts and feelings?
Yes, it does. It's another place. When you sing, as you're in the very first line of the song, you're in another place. It's peaceful. It's believing that something's worthwhile. Giving beauty to the line is a worthwhile activity. It's another place.
I have a photograph. Preserve your memories. They're all that's left you.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Saturday.
The teenager accused of killing two people in Minneapolis during protests over the police shooting of Jacob Blake was released from jail after posting a $2 million bail yesterday. Shortly after leaving jail, a photo of Kyle Rittenhouse posing with actor Ricky Schroeder was tweeted by a member of Rittenhouse's defense team. He faces charges of intentional homicide, reckless endangerment, and being a minor in possession of a firearm. Rittenhouse claims he fired in self-defense. He is due back in court for a preliminary hearing on December 3rd. Italy's culture ministry announced the discovery of another remarkable find in the ruins of the Italian city of Pompeii today. The site is currently closed to visitors because of the coronavirus pandemic, but excavations are continuing. In the past few weeks, archaeologists uncovered the exceptionally well-preserved skeletons of two men who died in the volcanic eruption that destroyed the ancient Roman city almost 2,000 years ago. The remains were found northwest of the center of Pompeii in an underground chamber in what was a large villa.
The two victims found in the last days are an incredible and extraordinary testimony of that morning when the eruption took place.
Scientists believe one of the men was in his 30s, and his remains still had traces of a wool cloak, indicating he may have been of high status. The second man has traces of a tunic and has a crushed vertebrae, which experts believe is evidence that he was a slave who did heavy labor. The eruption of Mount Vesuvius buried Pompeii and its 13,000 residents under ash, rock, and dust. The ruins were not discovered until the 1600s, and four centuries later, the excavations continue to show life as it was in Pompeii when it was frozen in time. We'll have more tomorrow on the presidential transition, how countries are coping with the coronavirus pandemic, and more national and international news. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. For the latest news updates, visit pbs.org/newshour. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Stay healthy and have a good night.
PBS NewsHour Weekend is made possible by Sue and Edgar Wackenheim III, the Anderson Family Fund, Bernard and Denise Schwartz, the Cheryl and Philip Milstein Family, Barbara Hope Zuckerberg, the Leonard and Norma Chlorfine Foundation, Charles Rosenblum. We try to live in the moment to not miss what's right in front of us. At Mutual of America, we believe taking care of tomorrow can help you make the most of today. Mutual of America Financial Group, retirement services and investments. Additional support has been provided by Consumer Cellular and by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. And by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.